OK, we're going to get started. On va commencer. D'abord, bienvenue à tous. Merci bien d'être venus aujourd'hui. On est très content de partager notre programme de transition pour des adultes TED avec vous, ainsi que quelques résultats de notre session pilote qui a eu lieu cet été. Notre présentation aujourd'hui sera en anglais, mais on est prêt à vous répondre en français. N'hésitez pas à poser des questions ou des commentaires. Hello everyone, welcome. We're very happy to have you with us today and to share with you our transition program for young adults with autism, as well as some results from our pilot session that we had this summer. We're looking forward to your input in English or in French. And let me introduce myself for those of you who don't know me. I'm Aparna Nadig. I'm a professor here at McGill in the School of Communication Sciences and Disorders. It's the program that trains speech-language pathologists, as well as conducting research on communication disorders. And I'm going to hand it over to my colleague, Tara Flanagan.
Hi. Just a few words of welcome from me and also an introduction. I'm Tara Flanagan. I'm from the Department of Educational and Counseling Psychology. Do a lot of work in the area of inclusion. And this has been a long time coming, and we're so thrilled to have you here today. And your input is extremely important to us, and that's why we finally have the opportunity to do this today. I wanted to let you know in advance that this is also being webcast. So at the point where we have questions, if you wouldn't mind asking your questions into the microphones for those who are online listening to the conference, that would be great. And I would also like to introduce our third colleague, Keely White.
Hi, I'm Keely White, and I'm a doctoral student in the School and Applied Child Psychology program here at MIGA, and I'm working with Dr. Nadig and Tara Flanagan on this project.
If I click here, is this going to work? Oh, it's really lovely when technology works. So I just wanted to highlight what we're going to be doing today and let you know that we are going to be as careful as possible, especially in terms of having a break. We don't want to overload you with information, but we definitely want to have the opportunity to really go through these different components of the project that we're so excited to talk about today. This is our official words of welcome until 2:15. We'll move on to talk about the transition context, and then at 2:45, the participants and the needs assessment results that we utilized in order to construct the program. From 3 until 3:30, the program overview. Then we'll take a break. We'll be having tea and coffee and cookies that should be coming in to let us know that we need to slow down in the talking and take a break. Then we'll talk about the results of our pilot session that occurred this July. And then finally, one of the things that we have thought about right from the very beginning was having your input. You weren't necessarily aware of it, but we thought about all of you in this room doing such great work, wanting to bring you all together since 2009 when we first started the process of applying for a grant for this project, and we always envisioned you in one room together and us having the opportunity to hear from you, and this is what we're going to be able to do also at 4:15. We want to be able to have your input and your vision in order to continue with the program and your guidance and collaboration. Then at the very end, we'd really like to hear also your thoughts about how the conference went. And then finally, you get to have a few drinks with us and chit-chat and hopefully create some connections with people who you maybe don't know very well, all the other stakeholders also in this process. So this is what we're going to be doing. And I would also, at the outset, like to thank you. Like I said, we are so thrilled to be able to have the opportunity to bring everybody together. Also the Max Bell Foundation, who generously supported our project, and I think is a granting agency that is really committed to projects that have an impact on social policy, and I think also one that's willing to take a few risks in a really good way. We'd also like to thank our pilot session participants who have really given us a lot to think about and who were so participatory. Our pilot session speech-language pathology facilitator and practicum student, who also worked really hard during the sessions and were very thankful for their efforts. To Jillian Mills, who is a student in the speech-language pathology program, who has been instrumental in getting this conference organized, as all of you have emailed her. And I would also like to highlight that she made the most equitable cookies known that I've ever heard of. She has vegan, gluten-free, equitably purchased chocolate chips cookies over in that little container for anybody who would like to taste them, and we'll have other cookies that may not be able to reach that standard, but those are coming as well from McGill. And I'd also like to thank Jesse Burns, who is a student who graduated from the speech-language program and who was also very helpful in creating the curriculum and especially at the beginning phases of this project, getting it organized. So I'll pass it on to my colleague.
Okay, we're going to be doing lots of changes back and forth today, so bear with us for that. So I want to talk a bit at first about the need for transition services for adults with ASD. Most of you in the room are quite familiar with this need, but I wanted to make a couple of points. There's a large gap in services for young adults with autism spectrum disorders, and this is especially true given the recent focus on very early intervention for children. However, ASD is a lifespan diagnosis. It doesn't diminish at later years, and social difficulties remain into adulthood and affect opportunities in the workplace as well as in the larger community. There are some research reports on long-term outcomes for individuals with ASD. One was conducted in the UK, and I should just point out that these individuals were born in the 1950s to 1970s, so a bit different than what we're dealing with currently. But for that cohort, it was found that fewer than 5% of adults at the highest end of the spectrum were living independently, and only 12% were employed viably. Okay, so very low rates for people who are quite skilled and have a lot to offer. So this really highlights the need for supports to help people to transition to be included in their communities and in the workforce. There's a more recent study as well that was conducted in Vancouver, so a little bit closer to our context and closer in time. So this followed children who were born 1974 to 1984 and found not so different results. So about 8% lived independently by age 24, and 27% had been employed in any setting, but most were in volunteer, very part-time, or in sheltered positions. Okay, so these outcome studies give us a couple of snapshots of how people are doing once they're sampled in adulthood. There's another study, however, that is quite interesting in that they sampled data at 5 time points over 10 years, and they followed 242 individuals with autism spectrum disorders in the U.S. And what these graphs are showing, I'm just going to try to highlight them here. Right. So what you have on the x-axis here is years since high school exit. This bar is when they leave high school. Okay, so years while they're in high school and then following secondary school or high school. And these are different autism symptoms as measured by the ADI, the Autism Diagnostic Interview. This first one on the left is for repetitive behaviors. This is for social reciprocity impairments. And this is for nonverbal communication impairments. So always the higher numbers here indicate greater symptoms. So what you see is that there are trends over time that everyone's improving in their symptoms up to high school exit. Another thing I want to point out is that these squares are individuals without intellectual disability, and these other lines up here, the triangles, are individuals with intellectual disability. Okay, so you see, first of all, that there are more symptoms in the individuals with intellectual disability, which is expected. They tend to have more severe symptoms. But what you see here is that at high school exit, you have a plateauing of their symptoms. So whereas things were getting better beforehand, symptoms are going down. At this point, you see a relative plateau and a change in that trajectory of improvement of symptoms. And that's especially striking for the individuals without intellectual disability, okay, the higher functioning individuals. So you see the trajectory is getting much better, and then really that doesn't continue post-high school exit. This is a similar chart, but this is internalized maladaptive behaviors, so things like being hurtful to self, having unusual or repetitive habits, withdrawal or inattentive behavior. And you see, once again, the same pattern of improvement during the years leading up to high school exit, and then a plateauing afterwards, which is especially significant for those who do not have intellectual disability. So they seem to have the most abrupt change upon leaving the secondary school system. And in this study, they didn't really pinpoint. Their focus of study was not what might be contributing to this. That's kind of left open. They were charting their progress over time. But the authors, their interpretation is that this may be due to the fact that the individuals who don't have intellectual disability lack stimulating environments after they leave high school. This is supported by the finding that more than 25% of the young adults with ASD without intellectual disability had no occupational, educational, or day activities that they were involved in once they left high school. And that number was quite a bit smaller for those with intellectual disability who often have a different set of programs available to them. Okay, so given all of this, our focus in our transition program was really to target young adults who do not have significant intellectual disability as they're leaving the school system, so post-secondary school age.
Okay, so I'm going to step back, I guess, a little bit and talk about the notion of transition and especially talk about why it's very important to focus programs for young adults with autism spectrum disorders on that transition from school into the community. So the notion of transition, oftentimes we don't give it the credit, I guess, that it's due. And we're talking about here is a change in role. So it's not simply just a change in age. Oftentimes we are focused on that component of transition. It's true that it is associated with age, but simply shifting, turning 18 doesn't necessarily mean that you're in transition. And this change in role is in accordance to what's expected in society. So our notion of adulthood and the kinds of activities that are expected around that is what we're talking about. Usually, individuals in this transition are taking on a new set of responsibilities and duties. And some examples of these are dating, completing higher education, practicing to get a driver's license, becoming parents, all of those kinds of things. And the main point about transition is that it involves a conceptual change, which means that you are not just going through those motions, but that others view you differently. So you are being viewed as an adult instead of being viewed as a child by yourself and by the others around you. And we're really interested, as Dr. Nadig mentioned, in this change from childhood into adulthood and this conceptualization. The transition to adulthood in relation to autism spectrum disorders, if we look at the research, there's very little in this area, as was highlighted earlier with the outcome studies, we're not sure why individuals are having particular difficulties at this stage, and we really have just a lot of best guesses. What we do know from developmental research in general, that the group that we're most interested in, generally aged between 18 and 25, are considered to be thresholders. So they're kind of on the threshold of life, is often how it's described. And those individuals are usually studying in some kind of educational setting, or gainfully employed, are experiencing some kind of financial independence, and along with that comes responsibility, and are usually involved in some kind of meaningful relationships, whether they be friendships or romantic relationships, and are solidifying their identity. So this is a time developmentally where you're really getting to try different kinds of jobs, different kinds of relationships, different opportunities to solidify who you are and to get to know yourself a little bit better. And this involves choices in your environment. And making your own decisions, this is a really big one. And as most of us in the room know, oftentimes we learn a lot from the mistakes that are made. And being able to make your decision comes along with making mistakes and hopefully learning from them as well. And the reason I highlight that is oftentimes when people have a disability label, and in an ASD label in particular, being able to be free to make those mistakes and make those bad decisions is often not apparent. So I just wanted to signal this as an issue as well. And we really don't know very much about what this transition looks like in autism, because the research really has been mainly focused on early years of childhood, on early intervention. And if we do have outcome results, they're usually objective outcome results in adulthood, but don't really look at the processes that have been involved in the outcomes. So the other thing that I really wanted to highlight is this notion that transitions require planning. And we really have to anticipate and create environments that are supportive of developing in the ways that I mentioned above. Transition planning in Canada really varies from province to province. And what I'm showing you here is obviously a map of Canada, but I've highlighted six areas where transition plans are mandated by the province. These areas are Alberta, Manitoba, Ontario, New Brunswick, Prince Edward Island, and Nova Scotia. These are the only provinces where every school board, every school is required to start planning transitions either at the age of 14 or at the age of 16. And so for most of these provinces, this is another kind of transition as well, from the individualized education plan to a more integrated individualized education plan, transition plan, or simply to an individualized transition plan. And this is important to note because what a mandate does is it really brings all the stakeholders together and alerts them that it is time to get started planning. And I'm certainly not saying that a mandate necessarily means we automatically have better practices, because it's not as simple as that. I wish it were. But it certainly gets everybody on board around the issue at a certain time. And that's something that I think is very important. The other provinces, as I've noted below, a lot of them have guidelines for transition plans, and I just put one of the examples from Quebec. We also have really good guidelines about how to plan for transition, what the best approaches are, but we don't have a mandate. I'll go over again. Sorry. The transition to my next colleague. There you go.
Okay, so we're going to start talking about our transition program for adults with ASD. We ran a pilot session of this past summer in 2012. And I'm just going to tell you the next couple of slides you don't have in your handout there because they have characteristics of our participants. So we had 6 participants in our pilot session. They ranged in age from 20 to 27. As you see, they were half female, half male. This is just a kind of snapshot of verbal functioning and nonverbal functioning levels. So most of them had either verbal or nonverbal skills in the average range. And in terms of kind of where they were in the education they had attained, almost all had completed high school, secondary school. Some were attending college programs. Some had started college programs. So that's kind of who we're going to be talking about when we present the pilot data to you. This graph shows, which suddenly half of the axis has disappeared. There's, interesting. Okay. So there are more numbers that go up that side that are not showing. These are their scores by parent report on the Vineland Adaptive Behavior Scale. So the scale measures adaptive functioning or how well they function in their environment. And as you see, all of them have socialization scores or social skills scores that were rated to be low. This green rectangle is the normal range. Okay. So although they had verbal or nonverbal skills generally within the normal range, this adaptive behavior scale really captures their disability in that they're not functioning in their environment in the normal range, which is characteristic of individuals with high functioning autism. Okay, I'm going to turn it back to Tara now.
Thank you. One of the areas that we really wanted to focus on was quality of life. And again, if you look in the literature on the kinds of questions that are asked in research studies where the focus is on autism, the quality of life of individuals on the spectrum is rarely part of that. And for us, we really wanted to make sure to focus on this component in our study. Just very briefly, quality of life is on the one hand about objective measures such as whether you're working or have relationships, those kinds of things, but on the other hand also about your subjective perspective on your own life. So do you feel that it is going well? Are you wanting to work and working? Do you have the relationships that you would like to have? Are you just generally happy? And these subjective components are very rarely seen in autism research, and this is something that we really wanted to make sure that we included. And the way that we included it was by incorporating the quality of life questionnaire by Shalik and Keith. And this is a questionnaire that has it's a standard questionnaire that has been normed on a variety of groups, including people with disabilities, some groups with intellectual disabilities, some without, as well as people who do not have disabilities. And there are 4 subscales, and it is the subjective perspective on these 4 subscales that we were really interested in learning about. So the first is satisfaction, which quite broadly is just, are you satisfied with the life that you have, the life that you're leading, the opportunities that you have? The second is competence and productivity. Are you engaged in the kind of activities that you would like to be engaged in? And empowerment and independence is the next one. Again, are you in an environment where you have choices? Are you able to make choices based on who you are and the interests that you have? And social belonging and community integration. Are you getting out into the community and having relationships that you would like to have? Are you involved in the community and activities you would like to be involved in? So these combined create a score, a maximum score of a possible 120. And we did this measure. And I'll show you here we have the pilot participants here. And I just wanted to show you in relation to the norms that were reported in the measure, where our participants were. And we can see we have our pilot participants in comparison with students in transition, so these thresholders in this age, also with disabilities. Our pilot participants, on average, had a higher quality of life compared to those students. Compared to adults with disabilities over here in general, pretty commensurate with that, very close. And then here, adults with no disabilities, their average on quality of life is usually a little bit more than 100. And all three groups, as would be expected from the literature, were below the quality of life for individuals without disabilities. One of the main things that we really wanted to do in our program was to be able to start a program that addressed the actual needs of the people who would be coming for the program. And this isn't always the case in program delivery. Oftentimes there's a standard way, and you know, it's not changed depending on who happens to come through the doors for the program. So we really wanted to start with a needs assessment, and then to do everything after that, in our power, to be able to individualize the program as much as possible depending on the needs. So this is something that we felt very strongly about, and is something also that is a little bit different, I guess, from a lot of programs that are available. So we designed and chose the curricula based on the participant needs. And I'm going to show you now the reported needs and in the areas of interest. And I just wanted to highlight also, we have our program curriculum over here and the manual that we have for you to take a look at later on in the areas that I'm going to be talking about here. And I'm going to show you the difference between the needs and the skills of the individuals who participated in our program. I think in the back it might be difficult to see some of the words on the bottom here, so I'll just let you know what they are. So in the area of communication, here we have the graph for the needs. So these are the self-reported needs of the individuals from our programming in relation to initiating, listening, perspective taking, making an impression, sarcasm, and nonverbal communication. And the black column is high need, the gray is medium, and the red is low need. And this, compared to the skills, also in the same areas, here the black column is low skill, the gray is still medium, and high skill is the red. And the decisions that we made in order to choose the programming were based on the black bars on the need side and the black bars on the skill side. So the needs of the individuals were considered when choosing what curriculum to present. In terms of self-determination, you can see here the areas we were looking at were problem solving, sensory issues, making choices, self-advocacy, and resources. And you can see here that there are a lot of black bars. There was a really high self-reported need in the area of self-determination. And in relation, you can see here on the area of self-reported skills, we also have quite a few black bars. So there were high needs and low skills in quite a few of the areas of self-determination. Finally, our third area is working with others. And here we looked at the difference between public and private in terms of contexts. Conflict resolution, choosing good partners for interactions and working with others. Getting the big picture at work. Making contributions, and electronic etiquette and use. And here we see some black bars in the areas of conflict resolution, choosing good partners, and getting the big picture at work. And then in relation to the skills, we have low skills in the area of conflict resolution, partners, and the big picture at work. In addition to asking about these specific areas, we also had an open-ended question with regard to the topics that individuals would like to see in the sessions, as well as asking them about the ways that we could make the sessions more comfortable and what kind of learning styles they prefer. Again, we really wanted to make sure that we're addressing the needs that people have and in the way that's going to be the most comfortable and the most conducive to learning. So with regard to the topics that people would like to see covered, in an open-ended question, the responses centered around managing change or unexpected situations, that was by most of the six, working within daily social interactions, and communicating with others. When asked about the best format for group meetings, half talked about visual presentations of material, and others talked about role-playing and group discussions, so more interactive and hands-on kinds of approaches. And how can we make the sessions more comfortable and supportive for you, not too loud, and having small groups? And these were all things that we considered in the development and in the choice of our materials. And the opportunity to work in smaller groups also throughout the 10 sessions that were there was possible. And I'm
okay, so now I'm going to talk to you a bit about our curriculum that we developed for this transition program and an overview of how we implemented it. Just to step back a little bit, we wanted to come up with one potential solution for this gap in services for adults with ASD. And we also wanted to make it low cost, to make it feasible, and to have it be replicable in other settings. So, and another point, we wanted to try to make this a capacity building project as well. So both Dr. Flanagan and I work in programs here that have students who are practitioners in training. So in my program, there are speech-language pathologists in training. And in Professor Flanagan's program, they are educational psychology students in training, and there's a specific stream for inclusive education. So students in these programs do practica or field placements as part of their training, and we wanted to make use of that opportunity, both to have them be facilitators in our program and to provide them training and working with this population that is usually underserved and that they don't usually get any training specifically to work with. So that's the model. So basically to have one staff person supervisor who works with two students, practicum students, to facilitate the groups. I'll jump to the bottom here. The groups, there's 4 to 6 participants, so small groups of adults with ASD. And since this is built around the academic calendar for the purpose of the practicum, the group sessions last 10 weeks, which fits into our 13-week academic semester, allowing for a little bit of time to set up and to do the pre and post sessions. We meet for 2 hours a week over those 10 weeks. And in these group sessions, we target skills that enable adults with ASD to adapt to transitions and life changes in the long term. So really kind of bigger picture types of skills as opposed to very specific skills. And in addition, it's the skills that they have identified themselves through the needs assessment. The participants in our pilot session and moving forward in our research study are going to be 18 to 30 years old with any autism spectrum disorder without significant intellectual disability. And we are currently offering this program in English, so they have to be able to communicate in English and be comfortable doing that. So just some kind of key features of our approach with this curriculum. We really wanted to integrate participant choice and decision making to emphasize that throughout the program. And this starts with selecting the modules or the content that we cover based on the needs assessment results. So what you see over here in these two posters, so this on the right is our full curriculum that we developed, and on the left it's the curriculum that we used in our pilot session based on the needs assessment results. So another point is that the curriculum is flexible and adaptable to different groups. It really, the content is appropriate for the facilitators, for us. It's very kind of broad, flexible material, and all activities that we developed were differentiated. So what I mean by that is that we kind of developed both less complex and more complex versions of each activity. So for example, in a less complex version, you might start off by introducing a concept with a demonstration by the facilitator, providing basic information and slowly building on that. However, if the group is functioning at a more complex level or able to deal with information in that way, we would start off with perhaps a role play or having participants themselves generate experiences to guide the discussion, and we would introduce more nuances and real-life complexity about the same content material. And so a lot of this touches on what we found from the needs assessment. So we used a lot of visual symbols, video models, humor to keep things light and engaging, and role plays. We were responsive to participants and to the group dynamic. So there wasn't, it wasn't an approach that we had to cover a certain amount of material definitively in a group session. We would really go with what was happening and what was being brought up with, by the group and the participants. And we tried to apply the concept covered to group members' issues and experiences as they arise to make this more authentic learning. Another point is that we really try to foster a positive and affirming atmosphere, focusing on empowerment through better understanding and better skills. So most individuals on the autism spectrum don't have a lot of opportunity to be in a very positive and affirming environment, and we wanted to create that here. So we were not trying to engage in rote drilling of problem areas or really focusing on that sort of approach. And another really important point is that we were trying to present things not in a way that this is normative and that's why you have to learn this skill because it should be done this way. So we really avoided that. And we wanted to really motivate why these skills are relevant to the individuals. So we did this by bringing the skills back to how they benefit the participant and what the participants themselves will gain from improving the skills. So for example, if you are acting in a way that's expected by your peers in the workplace, you're more likely to get what you want to achieve your own goals. So that was the perspective that we were coming from. So, once again, we've touched on this. So the three domains in our curriculum were social communication, self-determination, and working with others or teamwork. We're going to go over each of these in turn. And we developed several different modules within each of these domains. So notice that there's more than 10 boxes or modules here. So each of these boxes is a topic that we would cover in one of our weekly meetings. So we selected 10 of these that were the most relevant to the particular group based on what we heard from them in the needs assessment. So to start off with the social communication domain, So social interaction is a central area of challenge for individuals with ASD, and this continues into adulthood. We wanted to focus on communication with a really broad lens, so including verbal as well as nonverbal behavior and appearance, so kind of the messages that we communicate to people all the time, whether or not we intend to. And we emphasized communication skills that were needed for self-advocacy. So, for example, the module on initiating, so how to initiate questions, how to initiate searches for information that you need, and that would help them with social inclusion. So I'm going to give you, just to give you more of a feel of what the program was like and what the group sessions were like, I'm going to show you an example activity from the listening module. And this is about active or whole body listening. OK. Okay, so the idea here was really to introduce that when you're listening to someone, that you are not simply looking to interpret literally what's said, but more than that. So with your ears, you listen for the verbal information and literally what's said. With your brain or your attentional abilities, you pay attention to what they're saying. And the heart aspect is to really care about what the other person is saying and try to feel connected with their emotions, because often when someone's saying something to you, the intent is more than simply conveying literal information, but actually someone's trying to share something with you. It's a matter of they're trying to connect with you. Okay, so just an example. So just take a simple scenario, like a mother says to a son, "I baked muffins." So that seems like a kind of trivial statement. Why would they be saying this? Are they really trying to convey that specific information that they baked muffins? Or are they doing this because they want to know, that the mother wants to know, the son to know that she thought about them, she did something for him? Is she waiting for a response, for her to be thanked? Or does she just want to spend time with her son, for example? So we would follow this up with things like video examples. And here I'm not going to show you the video clip, but we had a humorous video example here of an employee reporting a problem to her boss. And here the boss is really not attentive, is not paying attention, is showing all sorts of behaviors that they're not being a good listener, right? So we would use this as a starting point to start a discussion about what do you see, is the boss being a good listener, what would you expect, and what would you like to have happen in this situation if you were trying to convey this problem to your boss. And this piece is really about bringing it back again to the participants themselves. So how do you feel when someone is listening to you? How do you know? What kind of behaviors do you see when someone's paying attention to you? And how do you want others to behave when you're speaking? So all of these behaviors can really affect how you feel, and it similarly affects how other people feel when you're listening to them. And the point here was also we always try to look at a dyadic exchange as a responsibility on both people's part. So it's not simply that you have to do this, you need to be a good listener, but also when you're looking to talk to someone, when you're looking to confide in someone, are they going to be a good listener for you? And how are you able to determine that? Okay, I'm going to hand it over to Dr. Flanagan again.
Thank you. Are we speaking too quickly? No? Good. Okay. Signal us if we are. I'm going to talk about the next two areas, self-determination and working with others. And just to give a little bit of context, in the area of self-determination, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about what we mean by self-determination. And broadly, it is acting as the primary causal agent in your life and making choices that are related to your quality of life. So self-determination in all of the literature is very much associated with one's quality of life, being able to make choices, being able to be doing the kinds of things that you want to be doing in your life, and having the relationships that you want to have really does impact your personal wellness. Self-determination is made up of four areas. They aren't necessarily four equivalent areas, as is demonstrated here, but the area of autonomy, so moving more toward having more and more responsibility, doing things a little bit more independently. The other area is self-regulation, so being able to control one's reactions in certain situations, and empowerment. This is an area that really is related to choices often, and to the opportunities that you have in your environment to be able to make choices and to feel that you are trusted to go and do those. And finally, self-realization, which is basically the process of knowing who you are and having yourself reflected in the environment and the activities that you are a part of. I want to highlight also that the process of self-determination is not necessarily something that needs to be done completely independently. And if we think about how we get at each of these four components in our lives, oftentimes it is very much in relation to friends, family who are assisting us, who are scaffolding. Sometimes it's also with professionals, psychologists, or other kinds of professionals. And it's more often than not an interaction than it is doing these things completely on your own. I think oftentimes that's one of the errors that's made, that we think if you're self-determined, that means that you're doing things completely on your own. You are really not supported. But self-determination certainly can occur in a context of support. So the need for self-determination in the area of autism, also like quality of life, is pretty prominent. If we just take a look at the research that's published in a database like PsycINFO, we see that autism research, we have 22,000 articles published around the world in the area of autism. It increases quite astoundingly quickly. This is a lot of research. If we look at the area of self-determination, we have more than 4,000 articles that are published. But if you combine both of these and look at the area of self-determination within autism spectrum disorder, so of all of these 22,000 autism articles and 4,000 self-determination articles, how many are about self-determination processes of individuals on the spectrum? We get to 27. And if you look at these 27, they aren't necessarily actually following and including in a program for individuals, and especially in the area of adulthood. So we have such a small number of research articles focused on this area. And since we know it is so highly related to quality of life, it seems very important to be able to address this issue. And if you remember back from the needs assessment, this really was highlighted also as an area where people had very high need and considered themselves to have low skill. So for us, it really is an area that we wanted to focus on. And because of that, because of the needs assessment profile that we had, we chose four modules in the self-determination area. These were preferences, interests, and strengths. So again, like Dr. Nadig mentioned, having the opportunity to really explore the positive components of yourself in a positive environment, not simply to focus on, you know, your areas of difficulty. Problem solving, and this is the example that I'm going to talk about now. Self-advocacy, so being able to recognize what your strengths and areas of difficulty are. How do you get what you need in an environment in a way that's appropriate and for that environment in relation to that? And finally, self-regulation. And if you remember also from the needs assessment, this was an area that people mentioned in the open-ended questions, but also in the quantitative needs assessment. So I'm going to move on and talk about the problem-solving component. Just give you an example. So when this component, when this module was presented, we first started with a definition of what a problem is. We talked about it's something that needs a solution and something that disappears when you do find a solution, and also something that causes stress when it's not resolved. And in the group sessions, we always had a lot of opportunity for discussion, a lot of opportunity to bring things back to a more authentic learning environment where people get to talk about their own characteristics, their own issues that they were working with. And here, we started kind of with a bit of a brainstorm. Can you think of any problems that you have experienced? And the note here is something that is very important and corroborates what Dr. Nadig was mentioning earlier. Oftentimes, in the curriculum that's presented to individuals, and especially individuals on the spectrum, we focus a lot on the negatives. And here, we wanted to also highlight that some problems are good to have. So, for example, you may have been invited to two parties on the same night, and you may have to problem solve about how to work through that. You may have two job opportunities or two college acceptances, those kinds of things. And we wanted individuals to think about good problems to have and also relate to the kinds of good problems that they've had in their past. And this is something that is very important. We also wanted to highlight that in the problem solving process, this idea of a solution, if the solution creates a new problem, you'll need a new plan. And I don't know if you can read this in the back, but it's a woman driving in a car, combing her hair, putting on lipstick, and she's thinking, I just love my new hands-free cell phone. So, you know, one of the things that really tended to work with the individuals in this group, they were a group who had a really good sense of humor. They really loved comics and, you know, humorous video examples. So we definitely did our best to kind of bring our points home using that medium, because it was something that was mentioned in the needs assessment. And from our first sessions, we also realized these were the components that were really the most memorable and effective, so we wanted to continue using those. One of the other things that we thought was very important was to be able to provide some flexible tools for individuals to be able to use at different times. One of them in the problem-solving module is having a structure. We called it the problem-solving approach. It was a step-by-step way of addressing a problem, whether it be a good problem or one that's not so great to have, and all the steps that you would go through in order to come to a resolution and something that worked based on your opinion of whether it worked. So the first step would be to define the problem. And in the sessions, we worked on really looking at all of the details, addressing what the context is, all of the components of the problem that you have. Individuals suggested their own problems that they wanted to work through. And the environment was one that was supportive enough for people to be able to feel that they could take the risks and you know, talk about their own personal issues. And that's something that, for us, is very reassuring and something that we had really wanted to create in this positive atmosphere in the beginning. So defining your problem. Step two, plan and solve. So the idea was to generate a long list or an exhaustive list of possible solutions. Now, it was also to not judge those solutions at that stage, but just to list as many solutions as you could possibly think about until you couldn't think of any more. And then to rate these possible solutions, and you can see here in the structure that was given, we have a pros list and a cons list. So let's say we take a good problem, the problem of having being invited to two parties. Your one pro, let's say one solution might be to go to both parties, stay up all night. And the pro of that, of course, might be that you have a really great time. A con of that might be that you're going to be tired the next day, these kinds of things. So a list of solutions and then thinking about the pros and the cons of each. And then providing a rating for those solutions. Numbered rating is what we did in the sessions. So which one is the best according to you, and moving down the list. And then checking, so did this work? Is this a solution you implemented? Did it work? if it didn't work, kind of like the slide that I just presented, did it maybe cause a different problem? Was it just ineffective? Think about why, review the process. Why might this solution not have been effective in this situation? And then kind of go back to the first step. And if it did work, great, move on. And another note on this, one of the goals, like I said, was to provide some kind of flexible tools that individuals be able to bring in a variety of settings and use, you know, a variety of problems per this example. And in one session, not in the session that was actually dealing with problem solving, a problem did arise kind of organically, and the facilitator very adeptly said, why don't we stop what we're doing, the subject that we're actually talking about, let's go back to the problem solving model and let's solve this problem together. And they went through all of the steps, defining what the problem is, a list of solutions, the pros and cons of those, rating it, and then implementing the solution and deciding whether or not it worked. So this is exactly the kind of thing that we were hoping occurred with the implementation of some flexible tools. So definitely in that case, it was effective just from an anecdotal standpoint. So our last area, and I'm going to give you an example from here, is working with others. And we started by just talking about how important it is to work with others, our peer relationships at school, our colleague relationships at work, and just our relationships generally really do have an impact on our daily living. And oftentimes, this can be an area of difficulty for individuals on the spectrum. And it was something that was mentioned in the needs assessment, in the open-ended question. One of our goals here was really to try to break down some of the unspoken rules, talk about things that, you know, are inherent to these relationships, but we don't necessarily see in a very clear way, and to make these a little bit more explicit. Again, to really to use visual and video examples, role playing, to make the learning experience as authentic as possible. And we really tried to focus on the areas where the individuals in our group would be most likely to be frequenting. So work scenarios, school scenarios, and we also made sure to ask to find out what environments individuals were participating in, and then to use their own individual life examples to kind of get at this topic. So the two modules that were chosen for working with others is knowing your context, which I'm going to talk about here, and what makes good partners. And the what makes good partners, we did touch on a bit as well, and Dr. Nadig mentioned the notion of reciprocity, and this was something that we talked about in other modules as well. So, you know, not simply focusing on what you are doing in a situation, but also being alert to what the other is doing in a situation and making sure that it is reciprocal on both sides and not simply you working really hard to make it work. So the what I'm going to be talking about here is the notion of context. And we really started this by talking about how we work with others all the time in our places of work, our places of leisure, really just even if you're out on the street, oftentimes you end up in interactions on the bus, on the sidewalk, and you really have to be able to know what's expected, what the context is, and how to work through that in terms of behavior and you know, the kinds of conversations that you might want to have. Also, when to know, you know, if it's a situation that you should really be moving away from, you know, all sorts of scenarios. So even one example, we talked about, the context, we talked about really being a combination of factors. So we really wanted to deconstruct this idea of context into the factors that are there. And the factors that we talked about were the people involved, the location, and the specific time of interaction, and how all of these things combined were really what determined the implication, I guess, of the context. So the behavior people expect from us changes depending on these things and this combination. So in the examples that we had, in the discussions that we had, we really had the group talk about these three components and then make assessments and judgments based on that. We really underlined the fact that just looking at one of those factors didn't give us a lot of information about what's appropriate in a context or what to do in a context, and that you had to think about all these things. So one example would be to talk about home. And home usually is a private place. It's usually a place where informal interactions are okay, where you can say what's on your mind, where you can have the reactions that you're going to have, and you don't really have to temper your reactions or your conversations. But we wanted to add the notion of people and say somebody who you don't know very well is over visiting. This then makes your home not a private, but more of a public place. And what's expected of you would be more in line with a public place. So certainly if there's a stranger in your home for whatever reason, you're not going to be able to have the same kind of freedom to talk about what you want to talk about or to behave in the way that is a little bit more flexible, usually in a private place. So as visual support, we had these three: people, location, setting, and time. And the facilitator was also very great in bringing additional supports, and she had brought three circle transparencies to really bring the point home every time the discussion got to this deconstruction of context. So every example that the individuals in the room brought up, she would have the circle that corresponded with the component of context that we were talking about, and really to get people thinking about this in this way as opposed to in a more global and complex way. You can see, again, the idea of bringing in humor and see this man on roller skates seemingly going to the grocery store without a shirt, and you know, compared to somebody who looks like they're running their errands in a business suit. And one of the things that we talked about was just this idea of expectations and what is usually expected and why is this usually expected. We did role plays of different scenarios, and people really participated to identify all of the three components that we talked about in those role plays. So we got to be active, but also have authentic examples. So some examples that we had were being at a party with a colleague, but only talking about work issues, or wearing formal or professional attire to a summer barbecue, these kinds of things. And people also suggested their own scenarios, and we were able to kind of identify the three components of each and everybody coming to a consensus about what's expected and why, and talk about also some of the complexities with these kinds of issues as well. And we also provided some structure in this process. We talked about, we wanted people to talk about their own examples of unexpected behaviors, but then also relate that to what the reactions would be. So the facilitator guided the group in creating this. filling this out and talking about a variety of authentic scenarios. And here the idea was that you list out an unexpected behavior and how this made others feel. So, you know, taking perspective, imagining this issue from a variety of perspectives, the negative consequences that you yourself experience. So again, bringing this back to a more authentic place to be able to connect your own life experiences with what's going on in the sessions, and then how you felt about yourself. And also the expected behaviors and how these made others feel. So we're really contrasting both of these scenarios, the positive consequences that you experienced, and again, how you felt about yourself. And like I mentioned before, you know, the sessions were supportive enough that people really felt able to talk through some of these issues and to really kind of put themselves out on the line there and really bring forward their personal issues that they wanted to talk about and their feelings, but it was done in a supportive environment where we problem solved through that. So these are the examples of the three components to the program that we have. We have a large manual, the implementation manual that contains all of the modules or most of the modules. And you can feel free at break time to be able to leaf through that, to ask us questions. And I'm very impressed with us. We actually are at 3:20 and our break is supposed to be at 3:30. So we could either move to break or take a couple of questions, or should we save them till later?
We could take questions.
If anybody has any question that they would like addressed before break, let us know. And if you raise your hand for a question for our online participants, they will hand you over the mic. No? If there aren't, okay. So either we're crystal clear or people are really interested in cookies. So either way, it's good. So we're going to come back to this format at 3:45. But I would just like to say, please feel free, come and speak with us, the opportunity at break, and then we're going to have a chance during discussion to get to know each other better, to talk about the issues. So enjoy your nice break, and I'll see you back at the podium at 3:45. Thank you.